with more variety than the F1 winner's circle, with more points than a paddock full of caterums, with fewer laughs than a Sebastian Vettel acceptance speech, the Autosport F1 Season Review podcast is here. Joining me, your host, Henry Hope Frost, our number one Autosport Editor-in-Chief, Andrew Vandenberg.
Good afternoon.
Number 13, Grand Prix Editor, Ed Straw.
Hello, am I getting paid double for this? Last podcast of the year?
You've just got a 5-second penalty. And making his podcast debut, and therefore unregistered, is our technical guru, Craig Scarborough.
Good afternoon.
And don't forget, there's double points for listening right to the end. So get yourself comfortable and away we go. And on that note, before we get into the season review, let's look at those new F1 rules. As things stand for next season, there will be permanent numbers, 5-second penalties and double points for the season finale. Guys, where did this come from?
Well, the main objective for the penalties has been to offer a slightly milder penalty compared to the drive-through, which can completely ruin a race. That's sensible, provided it's implemented well. Permanent numbers is a little bit of fun for drivers, isn't it? It's a marketing thing. You'll get a few of the big-name drivers will really get indelibly associated with their number. Double points for the last race? Well,
boom.
This is tremendously unpopular with the fan base, and rightly so. It's an idiotic move. I mean, from a sporting point of view, the idea is that it means there's a much greater chance of the championship going down to the wire, and it also probably means that you can sell your double points race for a little bit more money to your race promoters, I'd have thought, in the long term.
To me, it seems a sort of classic overreaction to and the wrong answer to a problem. No doubt this has come by looking at viewing figures for the final 9 races of the season, which probably went off a cliff after Vettel won 3 or 4 of those in a row. Having a little bit of spice so that maybe the championship doesn't end so early, well, that would have made absolutely no difference this year. When a guy's that far ahead, it would have all been wrapped up, 4 races to go, whatever, Ed. You know, double points for Abu Dhabi cuts no mustard, makes no difference. And all this is doing is trivialising what used to be a really sort of hardcore, pure sport. Mm. And once you lose those, you know, when you go in pay-per-view, you're looking for your hardcore purist fans, and having a populist measure, it just doesn't tally. It's completely sort of anathema to what the sport really needs.
The thing that's absolutely hilarious about this is that obviously Sebastian Vettel won the championship in India this year with double points for the last race. He'd have won the championship in India, so they've not even done their homework on it. Even if you accept there's a problem and that's the way to solve it, this does not solve it.
And people are saying, aren't they, that a win in Abu Dhabi is worth twice a win at Spa or Suzuka or Monaco or Silverstone or somewhere where you've perhaps arguably had to work harder for it.
If they're going to offer double points for Abu Dhabi, they should be double the penalties for exceeding track limits there.
Oh, don't start me on that.
I'm starting you on that because Abu Dhabi is the worst offender.
Okay.
You know, build some walls around it. Build some walls around the runoff. Yeah. And then offer double points for it rather than just having a car park there that you go into and you can't quite be bothered to make that corner.
I wish Jonathan Palmer was here.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. Mm. And while I'm on, anyone that opts to choose number 69, instant 50-point penalty for every race.
What, Nicky Hayden?
Yes, especially Nicky Hayden.
Oh, dear. Shall we get into the season review? There's no better place to start than at top, really, is there? And guys, another amazing year for Sebastian Vettel. 9 wins in a row, 4 straight titles. Are people finally acknowledging that he might actually be any good?
Some are. There's still a few holdouts who are convinced that he's driving a car that automatically wins the races for him without him even turning up. If you actually look a little bit closely at what he's actually doing, the way he's driving the car to optimise the exhaust blowing effect, it's absolutely phenomenal. The way he's doing things. And I think people inevitably, if the same driver wins again and again, people do get bored. But you can be bored with it constantly happening without running down his achievements.
Henry, you were there at the Autosport Awards this year. How amazing was he on stage? How funny and captivating and charming and witty and just generally brilliant was he?
Yeah, he was humorous, he was modest, he was grateful, he was fun. He showed an amazing turn of sort of slapstick British humour. Likes his Fawlty Towers, likes his Monty Python. Yeah, I wish people at a Grand Prix could see that.
Yeah.
But they...
The Helmut Marko impression about what happened at Hungary when he
didn't get
effed up qualifying.
And then effed up the race.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't... I think really it's a job of all of us in here and the rest of the media to really get across how good and what a brilliant bloke this guy is, because it's all, oh, he's some spoilt brat of Aisha, I don't know where that comes from, or finger boy, or, you know, he's just lucked into the best car. And there's so much more to him than that. I think even on his best day, Fernando Alonso could not captivate an audience like that.
I agree. And people say, oh, he's just in the best car and he doesn't really need to do anything, and it's sort of plug and play. He won 13 Grand Prix. Mark Webber didn't win any in the same car.
I mean, that's obviously a lot down to how the cars are working at the moment. And I think one of the reasons that there's been a lot of criticism of Vettel is that he's been driving a very similar type of car from the same team. I think next year will be a much stronger test when the exhaust blown diffuser is going to have virtually no effect on the speed he has. And I think that'll where it start to get a bit more interesting.
Yeah, he's been in a five-year rules cycle, hasn't he, where he's got on top of that. And well, we'll see.
And he's clearly mastered that.
Yeah.
I think the adaptability of Seb will see him through on that. I agree, it's a new challenge for him, but you look at it, he's excelled on groove tyres, slick tyres, all sorts of different rules. He's won in different conditions. And also, if you remember in 2012, he was having problems with adapting his driving style to the exhaust they were bringing in China. Famously, he went back to the less competitive version of the exhaust that he didn't, because he didn't get on with a new one. He did that for a weekend, wasn't so competitive, and thought, right, okay, I've got to get my head around this. He's very adaptable, and I'd be absolutely certain that he's one of those guys who's capable of zeroing in on the way to get the absolute maximum out of the type of car. And I'm sure over the next couple of years we're going to still see that.
I mean, pre this rule cycle that we don't have anymore, in 08, was Monza aside, was he standout in that Toro Rosso? Was he mega?
Yeah, no, he was fantastic.
Yeah,
if you look at the second half of the year, he was consistently up in the top eight, scoring points, destroyed a very, very, very good teammate in Sebastian Bourdais. He showed the class he had, and he's been classy in just about every category he's competed in, let's face it.
And from one new father to a potential new one, just a congratulations to him and his missus on their great news.
That'll be a quick kid, won't it?
Oh, he's going to be fast.
Mm. During the first half of the season, Ed, Craig, you've watched it all closely. It was very, very close among the Ferrari, Red Bull, Lotus. What did Red Bull do to the RB9 that made it so dominant in the second half of the season? Was it just down to that tyre change?
I think it's a bit simplistic to say it was just the tyres, although that was a really large factor. The Red Bull last year was already one of the fastest cars, and there was very few rule changes over the winter. And as they came into this season, obviously they weren't on top of the tyre wear. The car was overusing its tyres. And that masked the speed of the car. So in some respects, they didn't do anything particular to the car. The tyres really allowed the car to demonstrate the pace that it already had. But having said that, they did do a lot of work when the tyre change came out to re-optimise the car around these tyres, which is something a lot of other teams have kind of run out of the budget to do. So they had added speed to the car as well as making better use of the tyres in the second half of the year.
I think there's also an element of removing the negative with the tyre change. They were very much struggling to make the tyres last, and I think some of that was shrouding the performance early in the season. They improved the car, they did adapt well to the change in tyres, but I think anybody who says the tyre change artificially boosted Red Bull, it didn't. It removed a limiting factor, and I think the natural pace of the car, they were able to show that more as the year went on. And actually, this is what people have been asking for. People were saying they don't want the tyre to be a limiting factor. Pirelli quite rightly said, well, look, if you make the tyres much more durable, mitigate the degradation, Red Bull are going to walk it. And they did. And the same people complaining about the way the tyres are complained about the change of the tyres.
Okay. Yeah. Let's stick with Red Bull. Mark Webber bowed out of Formula One after a long career. And despite having the preeminent car, the sister car to Sebastian Vettel, he didn't win a single race in 2013. Will he be happy with the way his final year in Formula One went?
I think he can leave with his head held high. He had a strong finish to the season. He's not the first very good Grand Prix driver to be made to look average by a great one. Let's face it, he isn't as adaptable as Seb was. On his day, he could be at a similar pace, but his day didn't come around enough. But the simple fact is, he finished a pretty competitive second in this last Grand Prix, walked out, relatively speaking, on his own terms. So I think he deserves a reasonable amount of respect for that. It's not his fault he's not quite as good as Sebastian Vettel is. And I think we have to look at his career as, you know, he's won 9 Grand Prix. He's still on the podium in his last race. That's very, very credible. And he'd have loved to have won a race or two, I'm sure. But to go out second in Brazil, I think, was probably the most appropriate way, really.
He's the sort of Ricardo Patrese to Nigel Mansell, isn't he? He's sort of just overshadowed, but a top chap, and was good on his day, and everyone thinks he was, you know, he made a valuable contribution.
No, he's had a great career. Considering his initial short-term contract with Minardi, he should have probably started a few Grand Prix.
Yeah.
He said with what he had, that's pretty remarkable, but he's turned it into what he has and deserves massive respect for that.
Yeah, you wonder with the way Formula One currently is whether anyone else will ever be able to have a career like Mark's with the means that they start off with. You know, these days you need multi-million pounds worth of backing to get over the door and over the line in the first place, and well, clearly he never really had that.
Yeah. You mentioned Minardi, Ed, which just brings me neatly onto Fernando Alonso. See what I did there?
Yeah.
That's a perfect segue.
Yeah. You'll
get a bonus for that.
People will be turning off now, won't they? Double points, remember? Stick with us. Fernando was once again the nearly man, although that's stretching the definition of nearly, I suppose. How do we rate the Spaniard's performance this year?
I don't think it was as extraordinary as 2012, when he damn near won the championship in a car that wasn't even the second best. Mm. You can't argue with the fact that he's finished second in probably a car that wasn't the second quickest overall. So overall, that's a fantastic achievement. He couldn't really have done any better. There were weekends, I do feel, when Fernando got into the mode when he wasn't trying to the same degree. And now with Fernando, it's a little bit tricky because when I feel he's not quite trying to the same degree, it doesn't show in the way he drives. He just becomes a little bit more ragged and you feel that the thinking isn't quite there, the analytical mind isn't quite there. There are a few races where you sort of looked at it and you thought, it's not quite as good as it should be. Still good, but not quite to the standards he set last year. Very good season. Can't completely blame him. He had absolutely no chance of beating Vettel over the year, certainly with how strong the Red Bull came on. So the bottom line is, yeah, fantastic season. Not quite as good as last year.
He's been runner-up 3 times in 4 years with Ferrari so far. Well, it took Michael 5 years, didn't it, to win the title with Ferrari. So he's got to do it next year, really.
Yeah, it feels like he's in a bit of a different place in his career, though, whereas sort of Michael had done what he did with Benetton and went and was rescuing Ferrari. Mm. Sort of Alonso came into a Ferrari that had been competitive for a while, had won championships with Raikkonen, and it just hasn't delivered. And I think we saw this year him starting to lose patience with them. And you just wonder what impact this is going to have as they go forward. You know, if Raikkonen's sort of there or thereabouts in the Ferrari hierarchy, is he going to suddenly become the favoured one if Alonso's heading back to McLaren or wherever he's off to? I was just going to mention that we do this unique poll where we get the team bosses to rate their drivers, and last year, despite finishing second, Alonso was easily the team boss's pick for the year. This year, he's a very distant second, and I think that just sums up what happened in Formula One this year. He was the next best man, but he was a long way away. And as Ed said, it was because there were just weekends where, even though when the opportunity was there, he grasped it. He certainly did. But there were other times when he thought, yeah, he's sort of dialing it in a bit here.
Yeah, Craig, from a technical point of view, why did Ferrari fail to keep up with all that money and all that resource and all that sort of spirit and culture and fever and everything? Why were they struggling?
I don't think it was anything fundamental in the car. The problem Ferrari have had for a few years is that they've not had this in-season development where they've been able to design changes, get them to the track and get them to work. And it's one of these things that, you know, we tend to band around, like, you know, correlation or process. But Ferrari really just haven't been hitting the buttons with all the new parts. The car came out the blocks pretty quick this year, and that showed in the fact that they got their wins pretty much in the first handful of races. Mm. But after that, nothing that was brought to the car seemed to make it from free practice into the race. Something that appeared in a race one weekend wouldn't be at the race next weekend. It's as though they were throwing parts at it, but never actually completely expecting them to work.
Hmm. Ed, how do we rate Massa? He his qualifying performances in the second half of the year were better than Fernando's. Has he gone out with his held hard, do you think?
To an extent, but he's not driving as well as he was before his accident. He drove so well in 2008 and also the way it was building in 2007. You know, just drove fantastically. Yeah, I think probably the regs have gone away from him a little bit. It's not so well suited. Over a lap, he can be quick. He's not the most consistent driver. He's a little bit ragged. There are frustrating races. Monza was a classic example of this where he qualified very well. Most of his race was good, but there was just this period after he had to let Alonso pass, but there was this period of time before the next pit stop, quite a few laps, when he was 3.5 tenths off Alonso. And then he came back out after a stop and he was there. And you just sort of think, if you'd strung all that together, you'd have finished right with Alonso, and you could have said, well, I had to let him pass, otherwise I'd have been second. And you said that's great. He's very frustrating. He's got a fantastic approach, Felipe. I've got a huge amount of respect for the way he conducts himself and carries himself. He never allowed himself to get publicly critical of Ferrari, even when there were times when things were difficult for him. But, you know, he's a he's a perfectly serviceable Grand Prix driver, but I just he has not been a Ferrari driver standard for several years.
Will he help Williams, do you think?
I think Bottas is going to show him the way. I think he's the hidden gem of the season in a really, really awful car against a teammate that's probably underestimated in terms of absolutely how fast he is. I think what Bottas did as a rookie was highly commendable. I just wanted to throw back in there one thing from Massa's past is how well he was doing in 2009 prior to that injury, because that Ferrari was such a dog. He was really showing Kimi the way in that car that year up until Hungary.
Now, was that the tyre change? Was there a tyre change there where Kimi couldn't cope with it, could he? And
the balance,
or had he already lost motivation in 09?
I think in 08, some of the problem was that there was a bit of an understeer balance to the car, and Kimi would quite often struggle with that on a qualifying lap, which is why you quite often see him coming good and setting fastest laps in races, because once he got out of traffic and once the tyres had gone through a little bit of their life, the car would balance up and suddenly have a car balance that worked well with him. So I think that played a part in that. Obviously in 09 the tyres were similar, but Felipe was, you know, he's always been a derided driver. People have always had a lack of respect for what he's done. He improved a lot in 2006, and he was genuinely in 2008, if he'd have been world champion, you'd said, yeah, fair play. There are a few mistakes during that year, but there are quite a few mistakes with Lewis Hamilton that season as well. And you'd say, no, that's absolutely merited. And I think the driver we've seen the last few years, you know, the idea of him winning a Grand Prix even for Ferrari was pretty, not laughable, that's a bit harsh, but if you'd said going to a weekend, yeah, Felipe's going to win this weekend, people would just go, no.
Well, podiums are few and far between. I think he had three, didn't he, in total from 2009 onwards?
He had a vast dry spell. He had a podium in his last race before the accident. I think there were five in 2010, and then he went over 11, one at the end of 12.
Yeah.
I think one this year as well. So it's not good enough, is it?
No. Okay, let's move on to Mercedes, the only team that had both drivers winning a race this year. Nico Rosberg winning, Monaco and Silverstone, and Lewis winning in Hungary. Regardless of what the points table says, who came out on top in that intra-Merc battle, do you think?
In Mark Hughes's top 10, he's put Hamilton above Rosberg, but I'd be tempted to just put it the other way, mainly because, and I think something that Ed will probably get into a bit later, is while Hamilton's highs were highs, there were bewildering days where he just couldn't seem to get his head around it, and this whole braking feel thing or whatever, and I'm not sure drivers can afford to be so sensitive in this day and age. I mean, surely you've just got to get in and drive the thing, you know. And he was brilliant on his day. I mean, that win in Hungary, as you think, he was probably the only driver that could have delivered that. You know, he absolutely aced it, and he put those run of four pole positions together. But there were just other times when he was so disappointing. And those radio messages, just it really makes you question the sort of his mentality when he's and how calm he is behind the wheel, because he seems to be affected by the smallest things, and that's not how a Formula One driver needs to behave.
His graph was spiky, wasn't it? Nico's was more sort of more oscillating. I think consistency-wise, Rosberg was really, really good this year.
You can argue that Nico was quite unlucky to finish behind him on points. He had a few races where he missed out on points. Korea was a good example where, just as he passed Lewis, the front wing collapsed and obviously forced another pit stop, etc. I certainly agree his peaks were higher. Personally, I ranked Nico in my top 10 just ahead of Lewis, because I felt that Nico's peaks weren't quite as high, but his whole approach was really impressive in the case of Nico. He's very hardworking, very analytical, very technical driver. He puts a lot of work in the simulator, for example, and he knew what kind of challenge he was up against with Lewis, and he just did not rest in terms of trying to get the best out of himself. And I think going into a weekend, you generally have a little bit more faith that, well, Nico's going to be thereabouts probably, whereas Lewis, you never know what you're going to get. And I think next year, when we've got all of these changes to adapt to, you know, the driver's going to have to do a hell of a lot of work in terms of understanding what the car's doing, driving to order, if you like. People don't like that, but that's what it's going to be. And I know Nico will be sitting there thinking, yeah, this is really, really playing to my strengths.
Why was the Merck's performance window so narrow? Very quick in qualifying and then often backwards in races.
That was all tyres. The car overworked its tyres throughout the season. I mean, in the first half of the season, in the race, their tyre temperatures were 5-10 degrees more than anybody else's, and the tyres just couldn't cope with that. Obviously, in qualifying, that's great. That gives you a tyre that performs really quickly and delivers the lap time. And probably, in terms of underlying pace, I think the Mercedes was probably second only to Red Bull in the year. It was definitely one of the quickest cars out there. But they just couldn't keep their tyres together for the race. And classic example was Monaco, where you can afford to get a great qualifying position and manage the pace of the race, and Mercedes were able to do that.
Yeah. Was it ironic at Hungary, or was it just the facts that it wasn't as hot as we all thought? Lewis's only win was in one of the hottest races of the year. Why?
It was a little bit cooler, and also it was a race that came at a time when they'd been through that phase of trying to work and understand. Mercedes put in so much work into trying to understand the tyres. It was basically all they were looking at, really, because they had this period. Bahrain was a classic example, and you had Rosberg up the front, and he just dropped like a stone in the race. And Spain, not quite as extreme, but still went from first to finishing sort of fifth, sixth level. So they got to that point where they understood it. Yeah, the conditions, slightly un-Hungarian conditions, you'd probably say, for that race, did help them a little bit. But I think that was just the natural point at which they'd understood the tyres as far as they could. But the interesting thing is, I did an interview with Ross Brawn, which is in our season review issue, which is all about why this happened, and asked him, well, was it a case of concentrating too much on qualifying or the race? And he said, well, it wasn't a question of there's kind of a switch and you dial it to one or the other. We just didn't know how to make the tyres last better in the race. And they did make some progress on that, but it's incredibly, incredibly complicated. I think people say, well, do you set up for single lap pace or race pace? And it's very easy, and you just press button 7. So, button 7, that's sort of leaning towards qualifying pace. But it isn't. It's incredibly complicated. And the chemistry of tyres is absolutely unbelievable.
Mm. Lotus, then. They probably ran Red Bull closest in terms of performance. Given the difference in budgets, it was an amazing performance. How did they do that? What was the magic bullet for Lotus?
Just a very, very, very good team. Very good team of people. Very good spirit within Enstone. They have to put up with so much there, and have done for a long time. Way back in the Renault days, when you'd have the Renault president talking about, well, I'm not sure whether we want to continue with F1. They went through all the Singapore crash controversy. Would the team go on? The team gets bought out, then we have all these things going on in the background. Yet still, you've got a group of guys there in Enstone who are working incredibly hard. Very, very good leadership. I think Eric Bourrier deserves a lot of credit. You know, he has had to kind of divide the various shenanigans going on and the speculation about the finances, etc., and try and divide that from the workforce and say, right, this is what we're going to do. We need to keep focused. And they did it excellently. You know, the car has very good DNA about it. If you look at the last few years, very, very well, sort of well put together car, well conceived car, worked well with the tyres. Had a very good technical director in James Allison, obviously, who's now gone to Ferrari, along with the head of aero, Dirk De Beer, who's extremely, extremely highly rated. There are a lot of teams after him. So they have lost some people there. But what's most impressive is they seem to seamlessly move. They lose people. And I don't think any team's lost more people than Enstone over the last few years, both rank and file and the department heads, if you like. Yet they still seem to have a way of working that's preserved. It's not kind of a closed shop, one man working in his office does something and it works well. They understand what they're doing, and that DNA should carry through. As long as they've got a reasonable budget, they will always probably punch above their weight, whatever happens.
Mm. Are they the sort of last old school racing team? You know, the one built around the model that was successful for teams like Williams and McLaren before they engulfed themselves into this sort of matrix world?
To an extent, although I think I'd argue Red Bull's that as well. Red Bull's a very pure racing team in that regard. They don't get the credit they deserve for that. Red Bull doesn't interfere. They put a management structure in place and set their objectives, and they really work to it. But yeah, Lotus does seem to be able to do that. That, you know, in Eric Bourrier, you've got a team principal who's an engineer. He's a racing man. He understands racing.
And he keeps the politics separate, doesn't he?
Yeah, no, he does that extremely, extremely well. And he's been, by and large, pretty honest with his staff in some very, very, very difficult situations.
I think Ted Tolman would be proud.
Yeah, it's very much, I think, actually, Eric has been one of the unsung heroes of the year, really, along with, you know, a lot of the people in senior positions in Lotus. They've done an extremely good job. And actually, let's not be too negative about the ownership. Genio Capital have put a lot of money into that team. They have been investing. It's not been plain sailing all the way, but that team has been kept running, and it's still winning races and still overachieving, which actually everybody there should be really proud of, particularly when you've got teams like Ferrari and McLaren underachieving for the investment.
Yeah, I think it's a probably the most important sign of the modern times, that a team like that, which is able to deliver so much, is still unable to get in the big resources and the big commercial sponsors. And if there is a warning shot about the problems that Formula One faces, they're sort of encapsulated in Lotus and what's happening there.
Yeah, absolutely. Kimi walked over a pay dispute. That seems a bit amateurish and unnecessary, doesn't it?
Well, there was a degree of pragmatism about the whole decision. I think he did need some back surgery, and it probably made sense to do it at the time they did it. Obviously, he was effectively free to do that. It wasn't ideal for the team. You could argue it certainly cost them a shot at finishing a place, maybe even two places higher in the constructors' championship. Fourth in the end, obviously, no points in Interlagos because Grosjean retired and Kovalainen had a very, very difficult weekend. That's unfortunate for the team. You can't blame him too much. He hasn't been, Abu Dhabi, he said he hadn't been paid a penny through the year, so you can't really blame him for that. There was a window of opportunity, shall we say. And Kimi ultimately has done a good job for the team over the last 2 years. He's scored a hell of a lot of points. He's won two Grand Prix, and he's allowed them to have a focus of a proper driver who can score a lot of points, which they didn't have after they lost Kubica to that rallying crash.
But they were good for each other, weren't they? Because he was a failed rally driver that needed a way in, that hadn't had a particularly starring exit out of Ferrari. But he's sort of rebuilt his reputation with them, and they've used him to accumulate all these points. So I don't think they should... I mean, okay, the pay thing aside, there wouldn't be too much animosity there.
No. Was this the year Romain Grosjean finally elevated himself to sort of top-tier status? Because he had 4 podiums in the final 6 races?
He drove superbly in the second half of the year. It was looking very dicey after Monaco, where he was incredibly quick but hit everything that moved, including Daniel Ricciardo.
But he was hitting things that didn't move as well.
Yeah, plenty of things that didn't move. Yeah. They appeared to jump out in front of him at times, but I'm sure they weren't moving. But from Silverstone onwards, actually, Silverstone, he shaded Kimi in qualifying and then ran with him all race before a front wing problem dropped him down the order and put him out. But from Silverstone onwards, he was driving better and better, and he showed himself towards the end of the year. Suzuka was a spectacular drive. Got into the lead at the start. He had no chance of staying there with the pace of the Red Bulls. Managed to stay out of undercut range for the first stop, stayed ahead for one more stint, eventually finished third. But that was a superb drive. Austin was a superb drive.
Yeah, he led the most laps at Suzuka, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. His Indian Grand Prix drive from low down the grid after a misjudgment in qualifying, compounded by probably Roman not getting the perfect lap in Q1, and he came through and finished well up there. He became a guy you could rely on. It wasn't, this is a guy who's quick, who might have a good result in this race if things go right for him. He just became a guy who delivered.
And here he's got a golden opportunity to lead the team with Pastor Maldonado. This could be his sort of break into the real big time now, couldn't it?
It's got to be for him now. He's had, they've kept patience with him because he is potentially so good. And if he keeps doing what he was doing in the second half of the year, he's going to be one of the stars of 2014.
Another star of 2014, we hope, will be McLaren. It was disastrous, really, wasn't it, for the Woking squad? No poles, no podiums. First time that's happened in over 30 years. Not even a sniff of a win. How did a team with all those resources end up with such a lemon?
I think there's two problems, really. They started out with a lemon, which can happen. But a thing that I really can't get my head around is that how McLaren completely failed to recover their season. You know, they've produced lemons in the past. We've seen it, quite a few times over the past few years. The car they designed had to be different from 2012 because the 2012 car had pretty much run its course. They'd used up most of its potential. They've had a lot of criticism for the car being radical when it didn't need to be. But I think if they designed a conservative car based around the 2012 car, they would have been nowhere this year as well and had nowhere to go with it. Mm. So I think they had to roll the dice. But with all of their resources, the fact that they couldn't get all of these different aero concepts working in unison is really strange. I think even in the second half of the year when they managed to overtake Force India on pace, they were never really getting the feel that they were going to start challenging for podiums or threatening even to be regularly in Q3.
Ed, do they still have a sort of multi-layered system at McLaren where there are departments all working secretively from one another and they come together to sort of pool their respective resources, by which time it's too late?
To an extent. I wouldn't say secretively as such. You know, you do have to have these sort of structures. They did make some changes a few years ago to the way their matrix structure operated. I don't think fundamentally the concept of the structure is necessarily wrong, but you do need some focal point at the top, be it one individual or a few individuals, that can actually see the whole thing, that understand the whole concept, getting the whole thing talking to each other. That's where Red Bull have excelled, because Red Bull put a new front wing on the car. It's not just a new front wing that works for a certain set of parameters. It's a new front wing that works with the whole car, because you can do something with the front wing that can make the rear end not work well. Mm. And I think that's probably where McLaren have struggled a bit. I think they're not doing anything. They're not producing parts that aren't producing good wind tunnel results or CFD results. They're just not putting it all together right. And there's some fundamental errors of thinking and errors of the use of data and the way they're doing things that's led to them have a car that, well, as Scarb said, it started as a lemon, and it's, I'm not sure what's one step up from a lemon, but that was probably about as far as it went.
A lime?
Yeah, finished as a lime. That's appropriate enough. It certainly what's the top? Well, certainly wasn't a watermelon. That would probably be the optimum.
You would like to think that maybe once they realised that this was a fundamental concept that wasn't going anywhere, that all the eggs were thrown into next year's basket and that there's going to be some amazing car next year. I'm just not convinced that that's the case. And I know they do tend to go into these cycles of good car, bad car, good car, bad car. I don't really think they're in a position to be in sort of bad car scenario, because they're in danger of being left behind.
Mm. And they got rid of Sergio Perez after one season. Was that a hair trigger reaction? Was that a bit of scapegoating going on?
I don't think so. I don't think he was dropped because of the lack of pure results. Because his best finish was fifth, Jensen's best finish was fourth. That's about all you could do with the machinery. Mm. You know, with a fair win, they might have been, and a bit of luck, they might have been able to nab a third place here or there.
And he outqualified him 10-9.
Yeah, you know, Checo had a perfectly respectable, decent season. But that's not good enough for a team with McLaren's aspirations. Jensen's a very good driver, but he's not seen as your cast iron world championship shot. He's your number 1.5 driver, if you want to put it that way. And Checo needed to be pushing him and outperforming him, particularly in qualifying, more often than he did. He had a good run, aside from Brazil, the three races before that, when he outqualified and outraced Jensen, which was excellent. His race pace, by and large, there were plenty of races, even right from the start, the Australian Grand Prix, for example, where his race pace was bang on Jensen's. But there just weren't enough peaks. If there were 5 or 6 weekends where you thought, yeah, that's really good, and he comfortably ahead of Jensen, and there were 6 really bad ones and a few in the middle, you'd think, yeah, okay, there's a progression there. But he's just a decent Grand Prix driver. And that's not what they're looking for. They're looking for at least a very, very good one. So I can't blame McLaren for the decision they make. Kevin Magnussen is extremely promising. He's impressed in testing. So it was a bit of a no-brainer, especially as 14 has this slightly in-between ambience. It's a one-off year with a new Mercedes engine before Honda comes in. So if there was a year to do something like that, 2014 was it.
There's a reset button, isn't there, that's been pressed. And Kevin's got nothing to unlearn. Whereas some of the more experienced hands have got to forget about the 2.4 litre V8 exhaust blown diffuser era and start again. He's kind of coming in from a fresh perspective.
I remember when we did the pre-season podcast here, the worry was that McLaren had got themselves two very similar drivers, and that when the car was good, they were going to be really good. Or when the car needed a bit of hustling, they were both going to struggle. And I think that's what played out, and it's not what they needed. And when they plugged Magnussen in for that Silverstone test and he hustled around the car that needed hustling, suddenly was getting into performance areas they hadn't previously seen from it before. And I think that was when the die was sort of cast. And like you say, it's a bit of an in-between year. Why not take a punt on an extremely promising guy? They've done it before with Hamilton, and that really reaped the rewards. There's nothing to suggest that maybe Magnussen's not in that sort of same mould, and it could end up looking like a genius move.
Yeah.
I think the final race at Interlagos probably showed us that McLaren was justified with Checo. It's a one-off incident, but during Q2, made a mistake, put it in the wall. He was quick, capable of outperforming Jensen, but he put it in the wall, got a gearbox penalty, came through, drove well to finish sixth, but Jensen finished fourth in that race. Checo probably could have been ahead of him, and he just thought just these little misjudgments. You know, he was not going to be able to get into Q3. So it was one of those, you know, he might have gained a place or two on the grid, but the downside was absolutely massive, that it held back his weekend. And it's just these number of weekends where there's just one aspect of his game let him down, and it happened continually. It's not to say he's a dreadful driver, but you just couldn't rely on him.
Okay, another team that started the season very strongly and faded was Force India. Adrian Sutil actually led the Australian Grand Prix, didn't he? They seemed to struggle after the Pirelli tyre change in the middle of the year. Why was that?
I think the problem with Force India, or the opportunity they had, is they spent a lot of time late last year in pre-season, understanding the tyres and understanding their car and then redesigning the car all around this. And they completely understood how the whole package worked. And that really is what we saw in the first half of the season with this, you know, long run of points finishes that we had. But obviously, you know, they're a resource-restricted team. They'd spent their money up pretty much up front and then planned to spend the rest of the year looking at 2014. And when there was this big change mid-season, they just didn't have the resources to turn everything around again and bring the car back to the pace it was on the previous spec tyres. So they were kind of fumbled by this tyre change.
Hülkenberg's going back there. Is that good news? Probably for them.
It's great news for Force India. They've got a driver who should be in a top-line team, driving about in a team that size-wise and resources-wise is midfield. So that's win-win for Force India. I bet they can't believe their luck.
Yeah. Paul de Resta looks like he may be out of Formula One. That's a loss to the sport, isn't it? And we're not just saying that...
It won't be a loss to the post-race interviewers. But if you want a sport that contains the 22 best drivers in the world, then absolutely. You know, I think as... well. Ed, can I nick your line about Force India having done every metric of them, you know, assessing the performance and on whatever way Force India judged it? Was it 50 of them?
Oh, there's a massive number of them.
De Resta was ahead of Sutil. So, you know, there's very
in
little,
every category.
In every category. There's very little more he could have done this year with the equipment that he had, apart from maybe not crashing in Singapore. I think he has shown that he is a consistent and a fast Formula One driver in a midfield team. But this is a time when if that's all you are, you need to have a big wads of cash to go with you into the next team, and that's not something he's got.
It's just the attritional effects of the financial situation creeping up the driver ladder, if you like. Because now, last year we've got losing guys like Kobayashi, people are a good driver, but then it creeps up a little bit more, and suddenly you're losing sort of the drivers a tier above, which is it's worrying. I can't blame any team for it. No, Force India need to look at the financial side as well, and obviously Sergio Perez is set to be their second driver and will come with 15 odd million euro, which is a pretty good deal for them. But this is all down to, you know, the business model of Formula One, the amount of share of the revenue the teams are getting, which is a very dry topic. But the teams would like nothing more than to pick the first choice drivers, but many of them simply cannot. You're better to be on the grid with a driver who's a few percent less good than the one that doesn't bring any money than not being there at all, and hundreds of people being out of work. But it's Paul de Resta, I guess, is a victim of the times, and it's not necessarily got to its worst point so far. That's the worrying thing. You might see in the future it's even harder next year, and suddenly you do see it now just becomes a prerequisite for people to come into Formula One, unless they're backed by Red Bull, who don't get any of the credit they deserve for the amount they do invest in young drivers.
Yeah, that's right.
You just haven't got a chance.
Sad but true. We touched on Hülkenberg. He had a great season for Sauber with some really sort of stirring drives. Why hasn't he been picked up by a top team?
I don't know, but I find it incredibly depressing. I don't know what more the guy could do. Mm. You know, he sticks the Sauber in places it shouldn't be. He drives brilliantly defensive races. He shows the ability to drive to the maximum of the car. It delivers in all categories. He put a Williams on pole. He led a race in the Force India. What more do you have to do? Has anyone ever had more of a beacon flashing above them saying potential superstar than this guy? Yeah. And yet, you know, he seems to be stuck in some sort of ever decreasing circle of, you know, midfield opportunities.
And relatively speaking, out of nowhere in terms of their sort of pedigree, Daniel Ricciardo shows well at Toro Rosso, and he's sort of parachuted into Red Bull in replace of Mark Webber. Is that fair? Is that deserving?
I think so. When the vacancy came up, I did a column on autosport.com saying why they should go with Ricciardo. He's not 100% proven. He's incredibly fast sometimes, stunningly fast. Some of his qualifying laps really are fantastic. I think that's something that people have overlooked. And I think he will, certainly in qualifying, he'll be able to give Vettel for a run for his money on certain days. It's harder to judge the race pace. The Toro Rosso performance-wise was all over the map. It's really difficult to say how much that was down to the drivers. But I suspect basically what you were seeing a lot of the season was a driver getting 100% out of the car in qualifying, dragging it into Q3 when on pure merit it probably shouldn't be, because other drivers behind were not quite getting the most out of theirs. And then you regress to the mean in the race, which is why sometimes you'd see him go down and Jean-Éric Vergne would come up and people would say, well, Vergne's a great racer, Ricciardo's a terrible racer, but actually they just regressed to the mean. John Erik regressed upwards, Daniel Ricciardo regressed
upwards. I think he would progress upwards, Ed.
Well, if you're regressing to the mean, yeah.
Details.
Yeah, that's poor phraseology there. Verne went up, Ricciardo went down.
I'll go with that. Yeah.
Subbed. Verne gets another shot at Toro Rosso. Is that does he deserve to keep his place within the sort of Red Bull umbrella?
I think so. He's under tremendous pressure. He hasn't scored a point since the Webber drive became available. Some of that is down to some tremendously bad luck that he did have this year. He really was probably the unluckiest driver on the grid. Monza, for example, he lost certain points to a car problem. He was regarded very, very highly within Red Bull. He was seen as the guy that was going to make the play for the Webber seat, not Ricciardo. He was the guy that they thought, yeah, this guy's got everything. And he is very good in terms of potential, but he struggles to put it together. There's moments where he overdrives. Maybe the approach isn't perfect. I think his shelf life's not great in Formula One. I think he's going to be vulnerable to the old Toro Rosso mid-season chop if he doesn't get a move on and Danny Kvyat shows well against him. But there is something there. He's not as bad as the second half of the season where he didn't score would suggest. And it's good to see that he's been given the chance. People say Red Bull don't give drivers chances. Well, he's got a third season. He's got the experience now, and it's down to him to realise the potential that really is there.
I bet Sebastian Buemi and Jaime Alguersuari look at his performances and go, what's he doing that I didn't? Why is he being kept on when I was flicked? And as Ed said, I think he's very vulnerable to, you know, if Sainz Jr. or even Da Costa, he's probably off the radar now, but one of the other young guys is doing well, then, he's really got to deliver in the first half of the season.
I should say there were a couple of examples this year of how good he can be. Montreal and Monaco were just superb performances from him. He nailed it in qualifying. Excellent results. He had a sixth and a seventh place just on merit, just on driving extremely well on weekends when Daniel Ricciardo struggled. Mm. But then I think ultimately a big chunk of it has to be down to the mental side. When that Webber drive came up, we went to Silverstone. Daniel Ricciardo did a fantastic qualifying lap and a superb race. Was well up in the top 10. John Erik had, again, there was some bad luck there, but you just feel that maybe Ricciardo has a slightly more phlegmatic character who's able to deal with the bumps in the road along the way a little bit more easily than perhaps John Erik does, and perhaps that's the area he needs to address next season to allow himself to deliver.
Talking of being able to do better, Williams, equal worst season in the legendary team's history. Where did the car fall short, Craig, and how long have you got?
you could point it very simplistically at aero problems. There were a couple of key areas. The main one is that they never really got the exhaust blown diffuser working. And this goes back to last year as well, where for much of the season they never ran a proper exhaust blown diffuser. They kept the exhaust well away from the bodywork down there. And this year they reverted to a more conventional style. We even saw a Red Bull style exhaust and side pod appear for one day in testing that was shouted about, it was great, and never saw again. And they were never able to get the consistency. And this has always been the problem with exhaust blown diffusers, is that you get lots of downforce when you're on the throttle, but in any other degree of throttle, the downforce disappears. And obviously the drivers were struggling with confidence, not having this consistency in the car. And then as we saw in the last handful of races, when they moved the exhaust well away from the diffuser, which in theory should have lost them over a second of lap time performance, actually improved the car because they've just got this consistency back.
Yeah.
And you know, they're running the very same engine as Red Bull are doing, with lots of very clever mappings and very clever setups. So it's strange that Williams were never able to get on top of this. Equally, their front end aero, they mixed and matched noses and front wings throughout the weekend, and you never were quite sure what they were doing with their general aero direction. I think the recruitment that they've done this week will certainly help them go in the right direction for next year.
I think what happened with taking the car under exhaust off at the end of the season was something of a smoking gun, because you've taken something off the car that should have given it a big chunk of performance, could easily give you a second if you get it right, compared to not having it, probably more. And suddenly it made the car better, which was largely down to the balance. It's something of a smoking gun. But this has been the story of Williams for the last few years. If you look at 2011, which was the year when things really started going for the exhaust blown downforce, and there were some rule changes for 12, they struggled, they were terrible. 2012...
Got the Renault engine.
2012, they got the Renault engine, which is probably on the average circuit maybe 6-7 tenths stronger than the Cosworth all round reckoned to be. So you took the 11 car that was dire and scored 5 points. Don't change it that much. Put a Renault engine in it, have the exhaust blowing situation change, and suddenly you're winning Grand Prix. So that's kind of pointing to the same sort of set of areas as to where they're weak. And the great news for Williams is this exhaust blowing technology is basically gone for next year. They've slung the exhaust out the back of the car. You shouldn't be able to recycle it. You can't have bodywork around it. So that's a massive, massive negative removed for Williams. And so that certainly it's something they can't blame next season.
I think that the worrying thing is that they have missed this technical opportunity, and they've missed some others around the front wing and other areas as well, as I said. So as much as Ed's right, that, you know, they're going to get some advantage that this particular area has been taken away from them. But whatever the next area then comes up, they'll have to get on top of that. And if there is something fundamentally up with their technical structure that they're not able to respond to these things, then, you know, things don't look great for them.
We've seen the news recently that David Wheater, the deputy head of aero from Lotus, is going over there to bolster their team. Williams are in for Dirk De Beer, who was mentioned earlier. He's now gone to Ferrari from Lotus. They couldn't get him, so they've got his number two. So they've strengthened on that side. There have been some other recruitments, so they're trying to address this. But what Pat Simmons has always talked about is it's all about the process. It's not fundamentally about you change two or three things, or you put one person in a certain job and you paint the wind tunnel a different colour and suddenly you're doing brilliantly. It's about the whole working practice, the way you use the tools. That's the big challenge for Williams, and they've got an opportunity next year with effectively a clean sheet of paper to try and show they've made some progress in that regard, and that's going to be the big test for them, especially if the Mercedes engine is as good as people think it's going to be, because if that car is bad, they're going to look terrible.
Yeah, absolutely. We've already touched on Valtteri Bottas and his potential, haven't we, against Felipe Massa. Let's go right to the back. There were no points again for Marussia or Caterham, but Marussia did at least get the upper hand in the constructors' race. How important is that 10th place finish for them?
In the short term, it makes negligible difference. The money is paid to teams based on what columns you qualify for. They were what's generally called a column three team. You get a $10 million flat payment, which was brought in when the new teams came in 2010 to keep them ticking over. They move into column two for next year's prize money, which is based upon the finishing position this year. That's worth about $10 million, and you lose the $10 million for the column three. So they're relatively even for next year. But if you finish in the top 10 2 years out of three, you can, as well as retaining your column two money, you go into column one, which is where the big, big share of the pot comes from. And if they do that, if they attend the top 10 this year, next season in 2014, they will qualify for that, which can be worth, depending on what the overall revenue of the sport is, that can easily be worth $25 million, $30 million. So that's the big thing for them. And obviously, if they do that, and let's say Caterham's 11th again, that would knock Caterham out of the big money pot, which would be obviously massive disadvantage for them. So that's why there's so much at stake.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that, you know, Marussia have got that 10th position, that they've beaten Caterham in a season, in the championship at least. But I think Marussia probably internally won't be entirely happy that pretty much throughout the year they were down on pace compared with the Caterham, once Caterham brought in their definitive 2013 car around Bahrain, Spain time. So I think Marussia probably have still got some concerns that although they've got this money and it will help them seek sponsors, that fundamentally they're underperforming next to Caterham.
Jules Bianchi's staying on, isn't he? He's a good thing for them.
No, he's a very, very good driver. There's a lot of potential there. He's had a fantastic season. His 13th place in Malaysia, which came off the back of a very good qualifying lap, was what got them 10th in the Constructors' Championship. So they owe it to him to an extent. He's still got Ferrari Driver Academy status, so he's still seen Maranello as a long-term potential driver. So they've done extremely well to keep hold of him, and they'll be delighted with that, because whatever happens with the second seat, they've got a proper driver there who'll be able to deliver good results.
Is Chilton going to stay on? I asked him at the Autosport Awards and he said, "That's for me to know and you to find out," which was the end of the interview, to be honest.
It's looking that way. Before their second driver, generally they've done in the middle of December. There are there's been a lot of stories around about his father and the change around with Aon. But the money that was going into Chilton, it's not quite as simple as people have put it. There was a group of companies involved in putting money to him. He's been putting together this group again for next season. So yeah, it's certainly very, very possible he'll stay on. But there are a lot of drivers with a decent backing behind them floating around. And if I was Marussia, you're basically pretty much at the bottom of the pile in terms of where people want to go, because someone's going to join Sauber before they join you. So I'd be sit there just waiting, just let's see how this plays out, just in case somebody drops down from the table of one of the bigger teams with a big chunk of money who's got a big CV.
This is probably the point where I have my annual rant about those guys, but at least this year they didn't promise that they would be finishing in the points or on the podium or any of those ludicrous statements we had from Caterham in the past. So I just despair of the chasm that exists between them and genuinely getting out of Q1 in pace. And I honestly don't see the point. I'm sorry. I mean, I like the fact that Bianchi's got a seat in there, but what's the point? When you're so far off of being competitive, what's the point?
Yeah. That, what have we had? 4 seasons now? 10, 11, 12, 13. Mm-hmm. Not a single top 10 finish for, well, it was 6 cars, it's now 4. It's, yeah. I wish I'd gone to the bookies on that.
Yeah, the best finish was Vasily Petrov's 11th in Brazil last year, which got Caterham 10th last gasp. I think the other way to look at it, it is disappointing, but these are two teams with relatively low levels of resource. It tells you how incredibly good the established teams are.
And how reliable the cars are.
You know, that even the teams that are doing badly do things so incredibly well. All these long existing working practices. Yeah. It's incredibly, incredibly difficult in Formula One. People always talk about the fact it's a shame there aren't more new teams coming in, but it is just very, very hard. Yeah. That said, there is a point where you do expect to see them at least latching onto the back of it. There's no reason why Caterham and Marussia should be higher than 10th or 11th, but that chasm does need to be bridged, or at least see that progression that says a few years down the line.
Just one of them challenging to get into Q2. I mean, you know, get to the point where there's like a minute to go and they're in. You think, oh, they're going to make it. But you get there and there's a minute to go and they're fighting amongst themselves for who's 1.5 seconds off. I mean, it's almost like you know, the Premier League at the moment, okay, Sunderland are at the bottom a few points off, but then the gap. You know, there's like a couple of points separating all the ones fighting for relegation. That's interesting. You know, the fight at the bottom's interesting. They're just too far behind. And you can plot their progress, and we've got a little progress graphs there. I know it's expensive and whatever, but when the rules are constant, that's your chance to keep up. Next year, when the rules are changing, how far behind are they going to be then? It's going to be it's not an opportunity for them to close up. It's an opportunity for them to fall back.
Mm. It's also there's also an interesting problem in Formula One, again, coming back to the business model, the way the money's paid. Basically, you either want to be a front-running team that's hauling in loads of money and can have the big name sponsors on the off chance you can find one in these times, or you want to be a really small team plodding along at the back. The worst place to be is in the middle. But if you're an upwardly mobile midfield team, which is what the sport should be encouraging, that's the worst place to be in, because that's where you're having to throw money in. You know, this ever-steepening slope of how much you have to spend to get a return. If you're a Force India, another team that doesn't get the credit it deserves probably, you know, Vijay Mallya, for all the publicity about him, he's kept putting money in, he's winning to take Nico Hülkenberg on board when there's other pay drivers who are hammering down their door to take the drive with a load of money. But they're just in this really invidious position where they've got to spend so much money to be able to get into that sort of top 4 or 5 group without relying on others messing it up and getting ahead of them, because a McLaren, say, is underachieving. You know, they'd have to, not far off, double their workforce for a start to get up to that, not to mention all the, you know, the extra investment they might need. They might need a new wind tunnel. All these sort of things, all the CFD, it's just massive, that step.
It's just all a bit depressing, to be honest. I'm going to call time. That's everyone done. Let me get your personal highlights. Let's have some goodness and some fun. And personal highlights of the year, Andrew.
It was probably the most controversial moment of the year, but I loved Mulvey 21. I loved Webber trying to put Vettel in the wall. I love Vettel keeping his foot down and going for it. I love the whole personal dynamic, the false apologies, the real apologies, the Twitter fallout, and that's what Formula One's all about, and that's what we've been missing since Max has gone. Bring back the madness, the political subterfuge, and all the sort of headline-grabbing stuff. That's what I want to see.
Nice. Ed?
Not a specific highlight, but a general highlight for me would be Romain Grosjean going from this derided, allegedly crash-prone driver. He did have plenty of crashes, so it wasn't perhaps an undeserved moniker, even though people went a little bit too far. But he went from a driver who was very raw but had this incredible potential to a guy who, after Monaco, was teetering on the precipice of falling away from F1 forever. But he managed to bring it all together and just become this reliable, incredibly quick driver. He was performing better than Kimi Raikkonen in the second half of the year.
Yeah.
Overall, that's absolutely incredible to see, particularly with the amount of criticism I've had for the stuff I've written about why Lotus were right to keep persevering with him, because of how good he could be. And to see a driver being given the time by a team like Lotus, they stuck by him, they were patient. They were very patient, you would say, but that was because they knew how good he was. They could have thrown in, you know, a decent, solid driver who would have been a little bit more predictable and a little bit less incident prone. But what they've now got is a guy who, potentially, if he keeps this up, he's up there in that top tier driver. He is a guy who will win you Grand Prix and fight for world championships. And that's priceless for Lotus. And it's fantastic for the fans of the sport as well. What do you want? Do you want a good, solid midfield runner filling a seat? Or do you want someone who's capable of racing on equal terms with the Vettels and Alonsos of this world?
Craig?
In lots of respects, it wasn't a vintage year technically in the sport. Obviously, I've got this quite narrow view of the sport. And I think the one thing that really kind of caught my eye this year and I suppose was a highlight, something we'd never seen before, was the infrared onboard footage we had from the cars in the races on the world feed that we could actually see what the tyres were doing. And obviously, tyres have been one of the biggest stories this year. And you know, equally, Red Bull's slightly glowing hot diffuser, which produced lots of very exciting, ridiculous claims of what it may be and may not be. So for me, actually, seeing the sport from a slightly different angle, I think, was probably the most interesting thing.
Okay. Me, my highlight was, Mark Marquez, probably, winning MotoGP. Oh, hang on.
You can go with that. We'll allow
it. I was going to add in someone other than Sebastian Loeb winning the World Rally Championship. Alan McNish winning the World Endurance Championship.
That was good.
Formula One.
Le Mans was good.
Yeah, it was. Formula One, I think, nothing specific. I think when I'm really, really old, I'll look back and think I watched a guy absolutely taking the mick, winning nine in a row and just being mega, and thinking that was good to see.
There will be kids that look at the record books like I did when I saw Ascari. I thought, that must have been amazing to witness that. He must have been brilliant. And you think... It was, but look at no one really appreciated it. Yeah. You can wrap it up now.
We're done, guys. Andrew Vandenberg, Ed Straw, Craig Scarborough, thank you very much indeed. Like V8 engines, the Korean Grand Prix and Charles Peak, our time has come. Thank you all for listening. Look out for an F1 launch special podcast in late January 2014. And that's a lap. Autosport.com. All the news first.